Today, this is the podcast for the Seamus Heaney poems we're covering. We've got six of them to go through: Digging, Requiem for the Crappies, The Tall Man, Punishment, Clearances, and Keeping Going. Two from his earlier period, Digging and Requiem for the Crappies, two from a kind of middle period, The Tall Man and Punishment, and then two from later works, Clearances and Keeping Going. The first poem we're looking at, Digging, before we get started with that, let's talk a little bit about his biography, because that's going to be kind of essential to knowing lots of the stuff that's in his poetry. You see that he was born in 1939, and he just died a few years ago. He, from Northern Ireland, another Nobel Prize winner, starts out early, starts teaching. As I think I mentioned in one of the earlier podcasts, he's the first person to hold the Boylston Professorship of Rhetoric at Harvard and the Oxford Chair of Poetry at the same time, the two biggest jobs in poetry in the world. When he was alive, he was the best-selling poet in English, and it's because he writes in a language that is pretty easy to understand. It's not like trying to understand Keats. It's certainly not trying to understand Walcott, although we'll see a connection between Digging and Walcott's As John to Patmos there. His poetry, he's from Northern Ireland, right? He's the oldest of nine kids and is the, expected to take over kind of the family farm, except he's not really cut out for farming. He's more of an academic and certainly more of a poet, and so doesn't take over the family farm. And we see him kind of struggle with that in the first poem in his first volume of work called Digging. Like Walcott's As John to Patmos, it is an announcement poem. It talks about, what Heaney says he's going to do for his, for his entire poetic project, right? And it starts out, it's a poem kind of about Heaney's situation and where he fits in kind of with his family. He starts out with that first image of that pen snug as a gun. Right, that kind of an odd image, because what you do with a pen is you write, and what you do with a gun is you shoot. Now, this is a poem where he spends half the poem talking about his father, half the poem talking about his grandfather. So it's as if he kind of metaphorically shoots or kills his father. We could say that psychologically this is a resolution of the kind of Oedipal complex, where Heaney kind of comes to maturity here, right? And these first few images he sees of his father, and believe me, it's a song of praise about his father, but it doesn't start out that way. It starts out with this idea of a gun, right? And then when the first time we see his father, it's his straining rump among the flower beds, right? And he says that he's looking down at his father in line five there, the last line of the second stanza. He's looking down at him, which means, to look down with disdain or to somehow. So it's not starting off looking positive, right? And yet, the way he describes his father here, right, is despite the fact that the first thing he sees is his straining rump, is that he jumps back into memory till he comes up 20 years away. And so Heaney's writing this in his 20s and remembering back to when he was a little kid. And this, like As John to Patmos, where Walcott says he's going to praise love long the living and the brown dead and talk about the kind of the force of Caribbean culture, Heaney is giving us an idea not only what he's going to write about, which is his home, but how he's going to do it, by jumping back into his memory all the time. When things become too difficult in the present, when things become too emotionally kind of overwhelming, Heaney is going to drop back into this memorial space, drop back into the past. And so half of this poem is talking about, right, until the very midpoint of the poem, talks about him remembering his father when he was a little kid and how he used to dig and how he used to do hard work and how he was really good at it. In fact, he says, "By God, the old man could handle a spade just like his old man." And on that two-line stanza, the poem shifts to talk about his grandfather, who cut more turf in a day than any other man on Toner's Bog. Now, cutting turf is, if you look at the second link I show you in the intro, the bog poems link, you get an idea of what cutting turf is, right? Digging peat. And what this is, well, think about it. In the United States, our number one form of energy comes from coal right now, right? And coal, we know, is decayed vegetative matter that is compressed over time, right? Tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands or millions of years, right? major geological forces take this like old rotting trees and compress them down into these hard lumps, get rid of all the water or the moisture that's in them, and it we're able to burn it. Well, what if you have all that decayed vegetative matter, and in fact, in Ireland and most of Northern Europe, they do, and it's all old oak trees and old oak forests. What if you have all that but no mountains? What you end up with is this soggy ground called peat. And you see these guys cutting it out. There's multiple pictures of it. They cut it out and they lay it on the surface. They let it dry. If you watch that little video of the two-man team digging peat, they go down and down and down. They've got probably, you know, 30, 40, 50, 60 feet of peat there that they dig out in these rectangles known as ricks. And they let them dry for a few months and they shrink up. All the moisture gets out of them. And they're able to burn that. Now, it's not as efficient as coal, but it is a great kind of free resource. And every small town in Northern Ireland, every little village like McGarrafeld, which is the village that Heaney's family is from, has a kind of a communal bog. There's Toner's Bog there that his grandfather is working at. And every few months, the men of the village go out and they all cut turf and they let it dry and you take what you want from there. But here's his grandfather who... right, literally cuts more turf than anybody else because he's not taking a lunch break. He's there. He's just going to have a nice quart of milk, which is actually kind of gross, but that's what they had there, right? Nicking and slicing neatly, heaving sods over his shoulder, going down and down for the good turf, digging. Now, remember, Seamus, when he's going down, he's just looking down once. But here, his grandfather is twice the man he is, going down and down for the good turf, digging, right? And Seamus says at the end of the poem, I've no spade to follow men like them, right? I'm not built for this life. I can't do this, right? And then calls back to that very first image of the poem. Between my finger and my thumb, the squat pen rests. Instead of snug as a gun, I'll dig with it. So the pen, instead of becoming a gun, which it was at the beginning, becomes the shovel. The spade. And where is Seamus digging? Well, he's just shown you in the poem. He's digging in his memory. Just as these guys dig in the bog, he's going to dig in his mind and pull up all these images, right? And seriously, until he's 2017, he had his translation of the Aeneid released posthumously for, let's figure, 66, right? So that's 34 years, 44 years. For almost 50 years, a little over 50 years actually, Seamus has the same technique, digging in his memory to do this. It's, as I said, it's a song of praise for his father. And there's, if you look at the next poem, Requiem for the Croppies, it's the same type of thing, right? Now, this poem was written in 1966, but published in a collected volume in 1969. In 1966, the Irish were celebrating the 50th anniversary of the Easter 1916 Rebellion, a poem we've seen from Yeats when he talks about that, right? Because that's directly leads to Irish creation of the Irish Free State in 1921 or 22, and the creation of the Republic in Ireland in 1947. So the Irish Times was conducting a poetry contest in 1966 to celebrate the 50th anniversary of this, and what they wanted was somebody to write a poem about the Easter Rebellion. This is the poem that won. It doesn't mention the Easter Rebellion at all because Seamus is doing what he does, going back into the past, going back this time not into his own memory but into cultural memory and saying the Easter 1916 Rebellion didn't happen in a vacuum. The seeds of that rebellion were planted in a far more famous rebellion, the 1798 Croppy Rebellion. Not called croppies because it was mostly farmers, although it was mostly farmers. They were called croppies because of the way they cropped their hair close to their heads, like bowl cuts, basically. And this rebellion was doomed to failure, right? It was a bunch of farmers in Southeast Ireland who were rising up against British rule. But they didn't have military training. They certainly didn't have military technology. And the end, it ends up as it as all things must when you're faced with overwhelming military technology and superiority, they end up being destroyed. But the Irish love a grand failure, and this is certainly it. Seamus calls this a requiem for the Crombies. A requiem, again, I think we've seen that before, the idea of the prayers for a funeral mass. So this is a remembrance, a requiem for these Crombies, and the form it's written in is actually a sonnet, right? A love poem, right? And he takes on the persona here of one of these Crombies, one of these rebels, one of these farmers, who tells them that you know, our greatcoats, imagine a big kind of a woolen overcoat that was a typical Irish peasant farmer would be what they would wear all the time. And they would stuff them as they were kind of marching against the British, or not even marching, as he's going to tell you, as they were rising against the British. Then they'd walk through fields, they'd pull the heads off of stalks of grain, and put them in the pockets of their greatcoats. And this is what they ate for months on end. Because he says, we didn't have any kitchens. We didn't strike camp because we didn't even have a camp. In fact, we were really scared. We moved quick and sudden in our own country. But this great kind of horizontalizing of the social structure in that fourth line, the priest, usually the most well-respected, certainly the most educated person in any of those small villages, lay behind ditches with the person who's lowest on the social ladder, the tramp, the unhomed. They were all even. He said, we weren't marching. We were on the hike, the equivalent of we were taking a walk. We were, you know, day hiking. And we found new tactics happening each day. We cut through reins and rider with the pike, right? So when cavalry, when the British show up with mass cavalry and artillery, right? What the Irish had to go against them with was a pike. It'd be a long, a 6-inch bladed knife, maybe on a 6-foot handle, though, used in farming to cut open, to access, be able to get hay down from the second floor of a barn without having to climb up there, right? So they'd use those as almost like spears. They cut through reins and riders of cavalry with the pike. And then when the infantry came at them, they'd stampede cavalry and cattle into them, then retreat through hedges where the cavalry must be thrown. And Irish hedges are a lot different than when we think of hedges, we think of, you know, white picket fences and those green things that somebody's out there cutting once a week in the suburbs. But Irish hedges are, you know, 20, 30, 40 feet wide and maybe 20 feet tall, these big things that have been grown for centuries. And they demarcate large sections of land, like square miles worth of land. And they look almost impenetrable. They look like this wall that you can't get through unless you're just a single person. And if you get low to the ground, you can crawl through those. And that's what they're doing. But these guys on horses, they'd have to go 2-3 miles out of their way to a break in the hedge and then come back. And by that time, these guys had scattered, right? And this was their kind of guerrilla tactics they'd use until this fateful day. This rebellion lasted less than 6 months, right? And on a hillside in southeastern Ireland, he calls it Vinegar Hill, which is a deliberate biblical reference to Golgotha, the place of the skull, the place where Jesus is crucified, where he's given vinegar on a stick, and he tells him the final conclave. And it's another specifically religious term there. Conclave is technically a meeting of cardinals to elect a pope, which should give away part of the ending, right? Those men, those princes of the church, as they are called cardinals because they wear red. And they're going to elect a new leader, right? Terrorist thousands die shaking sighs at cannon. We know what a sigh is. We've seen it into autumn, right? We know that it's the death's hook that a mower or a reaper uses, or that the grim reaper uses, right? And they're just outmatched, shaking sighs at cannon. And that idea that they're standing on this hillside and they're terraced. Terracing is a farming term. It's a way to cut basically large steps out of a hillside to turn what land that couldn't be farmed into land that could be farmed, right? Basically, imagine some giant staircase going up to cut these even horizontal areas into a hillside. That's where they were, standing there like that. The British showed up, stayed a couple hundred yards away, and just pounded them with artillery until people were dead. And as he says, the hillside blushed. soaked in our broken wave, and that great idea of that double meaning there. The hillside blushed. Certainly it turned red with their blood, but it's also, it's such a slaughter, it's such a massacre that the earth itself is embarrassed, and that's why it blushes, right? Embarrassed at the inhumanity that's occurring. And the British, after they've destroyed these people, did what most victors do in warfare, right? They're going to bury these people, but they're going to bury them in a mass grave. They just basically dug a trench at the foot of the hill and pushed all the bodies into it. And as he says, they buried us without shroud or coffin, right? Just kicked them into this mass grave, threw some quicklime over them, and then covered them up with some dirt. But in August, right, a month or two after they're dead, the barley grew up out of our grave. Right? Here's the question, right? That barley that they had in their pockets, it grows up out of it, right? And this in 1798, right? The barley that grows up out of this, the thing that is, right, the seeds are planted in 1798, and the rebellion of 1916 is the fruit of that planting. Here's what grows up out of their grave. It's kind of a brilliant, brilliant poem there in terms of that. It's really kind of witty and sad. Now, the next two poems, The Tolland Man and Punishment, are part of a series of poems known as the Bog Poems. And these two poems are, well, this series of poems are kind of what puts Heaney on the map internationally. Right? What's going on in Ireland at that time is known as the Troubles. I think I've discussed just a little bit about the Troubles there. It's, you know, Northern Ireland, especially at the time, had plenty of anti-Catholic laws in place. And it's manifested, there were certain places where in every city where Catholics, they were the only places Catholics could live, basically ghettoizing them. They had lots of military intervention. The Brits would show up and militarily intervene against the Catholics. If you look at if you go to the teaching site again, there's a page called Bloody Sunday that talks about the Bogside Massacre. And you get an idea of just the kind of stuff that's going on in Ireland. It starts basically in the mid-60s and continues literally up until the mid-90s when it's finally solved. But during the 70s, there's a huge amount of what we would call domestic terrorism going on there. We've got these paramilitary organizations on both sides. If you know any one group from this, you probably know of the Provisional Irish Republican Army, or known as the Provos, or the IRA, although they're not technically the IRA, right? They're a terrorist group who are fighting for Catholic rights. But the Protestants had their groups too. There were the Unionist groups as well. There was the Ulster Volunteer Force, the Red Hand, the White Hand, and these groups. And what Seamus is doing is as a Catholic, he doesn't want to automatically knee-jerk take the side of the Catholics here, but he wants to kind of show the barbarity of both sides. And what he's able to do is he finds this series of poems known as, well, these series of bodies known as these bog bodies. And they become this metaphor for him to talk about the violence that's going on in Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland. And it spills over to England at that time. If you scroll down on the Seamus's bog bodies poems, you see all those excavated bog bodies. And these are literally these bodies that have been found in these bogs as they're trying to, you know, dig for turf or something like that. And he picks two of them. The first is the Tolland Man, and the second is what's originally known as the Windaby Girl, but now she's known as Windaby One. But at the time, she's known as the Windaby Girl. And Seamus, the reason why these bodies get preserved is, I just mentioned that these bogs are created from literally hundreds of thousands of years of oak trees falling down and decaying, right, over and over and over again, making this bog. And oak trees are filled with tannic acid, which is part of the water system that's in these bogs. And this tannic acid, it's what we use to tan leather. So it tans these bodies, it preserves these bodies. if you look on that page before you get to the maps of the map and the thing, you see the great Irish elk. You see that body preserved up from a bog, with all the after all the peat drying and everything. You could see the first picture of the Tallinn Man in a bog where you could see the lines where they were digging for peat, and then how they removed the body out. They now have a museum for him in Aarhus, in Jutland, which is where they dug him out. So you've got a few pictures there of the Tallinn Man. And Seamus uses these to talk about kind of the how humanity hasn't changed in a couple thousand years. The idea at the time of the Tallinn Man was, for most of these bog bodies, was that they were victims of ritual sacrifice, that they were killed for religious reasons. And Seamus is able to apply that to talk about, well, we're killing people for religious reasons as well. The Tallinn Man is really in three parts. We get those three sections there, right? Where the first section, he says, someday I'm going to go see this thing, right? And see what his body looks like. I will stand a long time bridegroom to the goddess. The idea was that he was sacrificed as a sacrifice to Nerthus, who was the kind of the Celtic equivalent of Demeter. I know we've talked about Demeter and Persephone before, right? The goddess who makes the land fertile. She tightened her torque on him and opened her fen, those dark juices working him to a saint's kept body. An interesting image there, right? It sounds almost sexual, opening her fen and tightening her torque and getting those dark juices. And he wants it to sound almost sexual, but in actuality, it's not really sexual, right? A torque just means any kind of round metallic thing worn around the neck. He's referring to that noose that's around the Tallinn Man's neck. And opened her fen. The fen is just another word for a swamp or a bog. And those dark juices is actually the tannic acids working him to a saint's kept body. Which is interesting because the idea here is not that this is a non-pagan thing, but would we actually have Christian things, Christian bodies like this? Well, if you go to the bottom of that bog bodies page and click on something that says incorruptibles, you'll see the incorruptible bodies of saints. And you see these Christian mummies, basically. First one dies in 1879. The second one dies in 1859. The third one died in 350 AD. So that's almost 1,600 years old and well-preserved. And there's another one died in, I think, was 1631 or something for St. Vincent de Paul. So they're known as incorruptibles. The idea in Christianity is that they were so pure in their life that the corruption of death didn't attack them. But here, Seamus is talking about, yeah, I could take this pagan thing and Christianize it, right? Now that his stained face reposes at Aarhus. And the second stanza is going to, a second section is going to mix that Christian and pagan imagery, saying, I could risk blasphemy to desacralize, to somehow debase something that we consider sacred, and consecrate the cauldron bog. Consecrate means to make holy, right? This bog that he's comparing to a cauldron, something we associate with pagan rituals, but things that go in the cauldron come out changed. He's going to make that holy. How's he going to do that? It's going to be like a cemetery, right? We talk about being buried on sacred ground or consecrated ground. Why do you think there are graveyards attached to churches? Because that's holy, sacred ground here. He says, that would be blasphemous to say these bogs are like that, but I can pray to this guy to make him germinate what we put in the ground. And the story here for the next two stanzas is harrowing, right? Because let me tell you what we put in the ground. So here's the background on these next two stanzas, right? Four young brothers, as he says, trail for miles along the lines, right? Four brothers lived in a farmhouse with their mom, and members of a Protestant paramilitary group thought that these guys were members of the Catholic paramilitary group, the IRA. Turns out they weren't. So they approach one night, Roust these guys out of bed, take them out to the front yard, torture them for a few hours to get them to give up other members of their cell turns out that they can't because they're actually not members of the IRA. So when they can't get any answers from them before dawn, they take these guys and hog tie them, which is to tie your backs and your tie your legs and your hands all tied up behind your back. And then they take all-wheel ATVs, tie them to the back of those, and there are train tracks nearby. And they literally just drag these guys along the train tracks until their bodies disintegrate. It takes them a few miles. And the image we get here at the end, telltale skin and teeth flecking the sleepers, is the next time a train flew along that line, the next morning, the commuter train, right? You've all stood next to a train, or you know what it's like to stand next to a train as it goes by. All the air kind of gets sucked up. Well, the air gets sucked up, and these little pieces of skin and bone and muscle and teeth all get stuck to the side of those sleeper cars on the train tracks, so that when it pulls into Dublin, it is just covered with little pieces of these bodies of these young brothers. Truly, truly barbaric, isn't it? Right? And that's kind of Seamus's idea there, is that let's not think we've advanced so far that we've actually gotten anywhere in the last 2,500 years. We're still doing the exact same thing that these people did 2,500 years ago, putting bodies in the ground. What are we going to get out of it? And that third stanza really brings it home again for him, or that third section. If I go to see him, I'm going to rent a car. I'll be driving, and I'll be driving through all these little towns and everything, Tallinn, Grabel, Nebelgard. And all the people standing there, they're going to know I'm not from there. I'll be watching their pointing hands, not knowing their tongue. And out here in Jutland, this place where they found the bodies, in the old man-killing parishes, I'll feel lost, unhappy, and at home. The exact same way he feels in Northern Ireland, lost and unhappy, but at home, because they did the exact same things that we're doing now, putting bodies in the ground. Punishment, the next bog poem we're looking at, and the fourth poem we're looking at here, deals with the same thing, just so that he's an equal opportunity caller-outer here. He's not just picking on Protestants for what they do to Catholics. He's going to show you in Punishment what Catholics do as well. And what he's talking about is that next set of images there, the Windeby girl, as she was known as at the time, now known as just Windeby One, who was believed to have been sacrificed because she was an adulteress. She had been caught having sex with, you know, someone who wasn't her husband. And in fact, people theorized, someone who wasn't even a member of their tribe, which is a terrible, terrible sin at that time, a terrible thing. It's a waste of resources, really, is what it is. And that's why it was condemned so greatly. And Seamus begins talking about how he begins identifying with her, feel the tug of the halter at the nape of her neck, the wind on her naked front. It blows her nipples to amber beads, right? Secondary sexual characteristics, again, like playing with sexuality, but not really in a sexual way, just making us conscious of this, right? And amber is important there because amber, we all know what amber is. It's petrified or fossilized tree sap. And if you've seen Jurassic Park, you know that amber is essentially the memory of these plants, the way the bog is the memory of the land. And the imagery he's going to go through here is over and over again, this nautical imagery, this imagery from ships, the frail rigging, her drowned body, the floating rods and boughs like flotsam and jetsam, under which at first she's a barked sapling, her shaved head, her blindfold, a soiled bandage, her noose, a ring to store the memories of love. When we think of rings in love, we think of wedding rings, but she, as an adulteress, doesn't get that. She gets a noose instead. And then, midway through the poem, he starts to talk directly to this body. Little adulteress, before they punished you, you were flaxen-haired, undernourished, and your tar-black face was beautiful. My poor scapegoat, I almost love you, but would have cast, I know, the stones of silence. And there's lots of baggage here, right? Your tar-black face was beautiful, right? Her body has been turned black by the tannic acid, right? But tar is going to be important. We're going to see a big callback to tar here, right? And he calls her a scapegoat, one who takes the blame for someone else. Now, we could say that, yes, she's taking the blame for the person she's, you know, we didn't find a guy buried next to her, right? So it's always the women who suffer from this. But it's also this idea of that woman caught in adultery, this biblical image. As the Tallinn man mixes pagan and Christian imagery, so too does this. Seamus says, I would have cast, I know, the stones of silence. You remember that biblical story of Jesus and the woman caught in adultery? The scribes and the Pharisees say, we got him now, right? We got to stone this woman to death. And he says, uphold the law. So let's ask him about this. Let's watch him tell us to stone this woman. But instead, Jesus says, let he who is without sin cast the first stone. He looks down and everybody disappears until it's just him and this woman left. Where have they all gone? He says, well, they're all gone, my Lord. Well, if there's no one here to condemn you, nor then do I condemn you. Go forth and sin no more. Seamus says, listen, I'm not saying I'm Jesus. And I'm not saying I would have been this guy to stone her either. But I would have cast the stones of silence. Meaning, I'm not going to kill this woman. But I'm not going to stop anybody else from doing it. Right? And in that way, I guess I am casting stones. Right? I would have stayed quiet. Why? Because I'm the artful voyeur. I'm not the guy who acts. I'm the guy who watches. Voyeur, again, a secondary sexual thing, right? The peeping Tom kind of thing. I make art out of what I see. I'm the artful voyeur of your brains exposed and darkening combs, your muscles webbing, and all your numbered bones. Another biblical reference there, but more nautical imagery. Why? And then here are these two stanzas. This kind of backstory here. I have stood dumb. I have stood and done nothing. Remain silent. When your betraying sisters called in tar, wept by the railings. So, if you're a Catholic girl in Northern Ireland in the 60s or 70s, right, living in the Catholic community, knowing that kind of your tribe is under assault by the British, by the Protestants, by the Unionists, right? If you have the audacity to date or to sometimes even to speak with a boy your age who's Protestant, here's what's going to happen to you. One night the IRA is going to break into your house. They're going to take you from bed. They're going to strip you naked. They're going to shave your head. They're going to handcuff you to your front porch railing. And then they're going to pour tar over your head. And if anybody comes to help you in 24 hours, they're going to have snipers up on rooftops across the street. Anybody comes to help you for 24 hours, they're going to be shoot, not to be killed, but shoot to be kneecapped, because you're there as an example of what happens when you betray the tribe. Obviously, that guy was talking to you because he thought you were beautiful. You are never going to be beautiful again. Why? That hot tar poured over your shaved head, that's going to sit there for 24 hours. How are you going to get it off? Are you going to reheat it? Reopen those burns? Reburn your head? Or are you going to pop it off, peel it off, in which case you open those wounds again and you're permanently scarred. And Seamus kind of admits his guilt in this. I did nothing. I stood dumb when I saw this happening, right? Oh, I would connive in civilized outrage, right? And notice the word connive there, right? Not think, not be upset or anything. Connive, it's always a little sneaky, right? In civilized outrage, right? Oh, of course we're upset at this. Of course we think it's barbaric. Yes. But he understands the exact and tribal intimate revenge. Does not the tribe have the right to protect itself? And this is kind of the fundamental question that he asks. Can't the tribe protect itself? Can't we do this? Right? And I realize this has gone a little long, so I'm going to stop and do the last two in another podcast.